Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
In Valley News tonight, these top stories. The landlady of a boarding house arrested in connection with the murder of seven of her tenants. Authorities say they'll go for the death penalty. And many people are asking, how could it happen? How could a convicted felon end up running a boarding house? As Juanita Stevenson found out, it's easier than you might think, and she joins us right now with more on that report.
Well, Don, boarding homes are probably the least regulated shelters there are.
Get your
D-O-R-O-T-H-E-A.
Now,
is P-U-E-N-T-E.
Age?
I'll be 60 in January.
Date of birth?
1-9-29.
Going back, of course, you know how this whole thing got started was because of this last individual,
right?
Montoya.
Right.
Now, his disappearance is very suspicious. I can tell you that. Even the things that you said didn't even quite connect with what the other individual told us when she spoke to you. There were a lot of inconsistencies in your statement.
Well, you know, I didn't think I was ever going to have to remember everything. And
that's fine. I mean, I can understand that, and you explain that to us. Who is lying to me, Dorothea?
Well, I'm not. He was there Saturday and Sunday.
Now, how long did Ben live there?
Just 2 months.
Okay. So Ben Fink lived there 2 months.
Right.
Right. And when he all of a sudden disappeared, she started thinking, what the heck's going on here? And then she got the inconsistent things about, you tell me that the guy was from... you didn't know where he went, and then she got a phone call, and she says that you told her he went to Utah. I mean, there's a lot of things, Dorothea, that I don't understand.
There's, I don't know where the man was going to take him.
Here's the garden area,
mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Then there's some concrete here, and then they have a shed right there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then in front of the shed, you have a little bit more concrete with little circles, and I believe those are some kind of bush. This area, you know that?
Mm-hmm.
Where the concrete's only about an inch thick. But what I'm saying is, that concrete hasn't been there that long. I'm appealing to you. I'm appealing to you, Dorothea. That's what I'm saying is nothing makes sense. Nothing. Everything you said was inconsistent with what somebody else said. When you sat in there, it was like sticking your foot in your own mouth. I couldn't believe you were telling me that. I need questions answered, Dorothea.
I try to look
you straight in the eye.
Well, I'm trying to look at you too, but they
I want the truth.
But they say if you keep looking at somebody, you're telling a lie.
No, because when you look at me, I'm looking at your eyes. I'm watching you.
Imagine a quiet, tree-lined street in downtown Sacramento in the 1980s. This is F Street at 1426. There sits a two-story, small, powder blue Victorian boarding house. The homeowner is a pillar of her community. Well-respected, seemingly kind, she tends to her garden, hands out cookies, and promises vulnerable people a safe place to stay. To local charities and social workers, she was a hero who took in those that no one else would. But beneath the flowers and apricot trees in her garden and behind the lace curtains in her windows, something sinister was happening. The truth came to light on November 11th, 1988, when police arrived at the home, searching for missing 51-year-old Bert Montoya. This boarding house was Montoya's last known address. And little did police know, this disappearance would lead them to an elderly female serial killer. Rumors of suspicious activity in the homeowner's back garden led police to dig. They would ultimately find the human remains of seven victims. In today's episode, we're exploring how a grandmotherly caretaker became one of America's most infamous serial killers, known as the Death House Landlady. We'll walk through her troubled past, the twisted schemes she used to target society's most vulnerable, and the investigation that would finally expose the horrors hidden at 1426 F Street. If you lived in Sacramento, California in the 1980s, you will recognize this name. This is the story of Dorothea Puente. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Kadra. If you're new to the show, hello and welcome. I tell tales every single week that have perplexed me. So if you love a good mystery that leaves you wanting more, don't worry, you're in the right place. And if you end up enjoying today's true crime deep dive all about Dorothea Puente, I would love if you continue to follow along. If you are a returning listener, hello, my friends. Welcome back. I'm happy you're here today. This has been on my mind for the last several weeks. I've been deep diving Dorothea Puente, and a TikTok user actually suggested this quite a while back, Ridgeback Mom. So thank you for recommending this. I'm finally getting to it. And wow, I had never heard of Dorothea Puente. I will tell you guys now, this is a very sad story, very upsetting. So trigger warning, as always, for true crime cases. We're going to be getting into murder, of course, also abuse and suicide. So please take care while listening. And there are a lot of sources that I used for today's episode, including a couple of books. So those will all be down in the show notes. Without further ado, let's dive right in to Dorothea Puente. So Dorothea Gray was born in San Bernardino County in the Redlands of California on January 9th, 1929. She was the sixth of seven children. Her father, Jesse, was a World War I veteran who suffered from lung issues and PTSD. He was once a successful farmer, but after the war, he turned to alcohol and became suicidal. Jesse would repeatedly threaten to kill himself, holding a gun to his head in front of his own children. So this obviously put his kids into extreme duress, and only when they were like in total hysteria would Jesse cool down. As for Trudy, Dorothea's mother, she was a mother only in name. She often remarked how much she hated being a mother. Trudy was not even slightly maternal. She was mean, and she, like Jesse, was an alcoholic. She was also abusive and neglectful. She was known to abandon her kids for days at a time, sometimes locking the younger children in a closet while she took off for several days on benders. There were also times that she would come back from these benders, vomit everywhere, and expect the children to clean it up. So because of severe neglect from Jesse and Trudy, Dorothea was raised by her siblings. They would often scavenge in the streets for food. Sometimes their neighbors would step in and feed them and clothe them. During Dorothea's time in the streets, she was also sexually abused. Her neighborhood was filled with a lot of Hispanic people, and Dorothea would later say it was often the Hispanic families that would care for her the most. And you'll see this come up a lot later in the story. She learned a decent amount of Spanish because of this as well. Then Jesse got sick, and the Grays had to move to LA to be closer to the VA hospital for his treatments. Dorothea's father was now unable to work, so Trudy started doing sex work to make ends meet. The children also took up various odd jobs, so Dorothea started working when she was very young. In 1937, Dorothea's father, Jesse Gray, would die from tuberculosis complications. Dorothea was only 8 years old. Dorothea's mother, Trudy, then finally lost custody of the children, but this would, of course, result in the children going into the adoption agency, into orphanages, and they were all split up. This happened after a family member finally reported the abuse. But this was incredibly difficult for Dorothea because she was now separated from her siblings who had raised her, so this was like the only semblance of a family that she had ever had. I think this would have really, really messed with her psyche. And again, you see things like this throughout the story, how she's unable to attach to people. When Dorothea was 10 years old, she was sent to live in an orphanage in Ontario, California. During this time, she ran away several times, having difficulty attaching to or trusting anyone. And she would later say that she was taken in by some nice families, but she just couldn't bring herself to grow attached. She felt she was a lone wolf. Dorothea's mother, Trudy, also later died in a motorcycle accident after she ran off with her boyfriend's motorcycle gang. From the time that Dorothea was 16 years old, she also, like her mother, became involved in sex work. Dorothea would also marry several times throughout her life, and each time she married, she would tell these insanely lavish, embellished, ridiculous stories. She would go under false names, she would lie about her age, so her husbands never really knew who she was until it was too late. Her first marriage was when she was only 16, and she married a man named Fred. However, her marriage certificate said she was 30, and she went under a false name. So it seems Fred didn't know how young she actually was. And this is where we start to see what will be a never-ending pattern. Dorothea was a pathological liar. Throughout her life, she lived in survival mode, saying whatever lie was convenient for her at the time to get people to like and trust her. And it seems some of the lies were out of childhood fantasy, meaning she really, really wanted them to be true. And some seemed so real to her that she led herself to believe them. But others were just plain ridiculous or for her convenience. She gave birth to a daughter in 1946, followed by a second child less than a year later. This is where you begin to see Dorothea's coldness, and similar to Trudy, she was unable to attach. She wasn't maternal. So she started drinking, and she ended up giving her children away. Public documents suggest one of Dorothea's daughters was placed very quickly into the care of a relative, and the other was put up for adoption. These children were with her first husband, Fred, and she did all of this without telling him. So this obviously would create a huge rift in their marriage. This second child that she put up for adoption was actually given away while Fred was at work. She had the baby, put her up for adoption, and didn't tell him. She signed away all the rights, and Fred was heartbroken. Soon after this, Dorothea got pregnant by another man. So, as if their marriage wasn't already shattered, this was the final straw for Fred. She was 19 at this point, and Fred left her. He couldn't take it anymore. When people would ask what had happened to Fred, Dorothea would also lie and say that he was a war hero who had died in battle. She would tell this story for many years to many people. She also began her life of crime, forging checks, and she eventually got caught. This would be the first time of many that Dorothea would get caught, though. And she never seemed to stay in jail for long. So at this time, she was sentenced to a year, but she served just 4 months. Then Dorothea got married again. Her second marriage was to a Swedish sea merchant named Axel Johansson. And she once again told him extravagant stories and went under a false name. Dorothea claimed that she was a former professional chef turned rockette. She claimed her parents were Egyptian and Israeli, and that her last husband, Fred, had died in battle. When Axel was away for work, Dorothea continued to drink heavily. She also gambled away all of Axel's money and brought other men back to the house. It was around this time that Dorothea saw the world of caregiving open up to her. Back then, there were minimal qualifications to take people in or do medical care. Dorothea saw opportunity, dollar signs. She started telling people that she was a holistic doctor and healer. Of course, none of this was true. She had no medical training whatsoever. But Dorothea was so charismatic, so charming and seemingly innocent, that people very often believed her. She also opened an undercover brothel, so it's like she would really do anything she could to make money. She got caught running this illegal brothel, and when she did, she initially tried to lie to police. They did like this sting operation where they showed up
It was really weird. They like put this powder on their hands and touched the people that were in the brothel so that they could like mark them and prove later what they were doing. But they were like touching their boobs and stuff. It was really weird. It's a weird story. But she initially was like, oh my gosh, I had no idea I was even in a brothel. Like, girl, come on. She served just 90 days in jail as well, and she was still married to Axel Johansson throughout this time. He started becoming abusive, and he had her committed to a psychiatric facility, but Dorothea ran away. They ended up getting divorced a couple years later. In 1981, Dorothea rented a new apartment on her own, going under another false name. She went by Sharon Johansson, keeping the last name of her former husband, Axel. She soon began to take people in, and she treated the place as a boarding house. She called the place the Samaritans. This was absolutely illegal. She was not licensed. Dorothea began targeting vulnerable populations: alcoholics, homeless, intellectually disabled, medically fragile adults. She would agree to take them in, care for them, so long as they agreed to make her the payee on their government checks. She also had an assistant, TJ Hosley, who would run things for her when she was away. And that's one of the mysteries about Dorothea, is how many people knew what she was actually doing and were accomplices. Soon after this, Dorothea met her third husband, Roberto Jose Puente, leading to her infamous name, Dorothea Puente. Roberto was 20 years younger than Dorothea, and they got married in Mexico City. But Roberto, similar to how Dorothea was in her prior marriages, was unfaithful. In response to one of these affairs, Dorothea knocked out Roberto in a single punch, which is obviously spousal abuse and shows how strong she was. It's also pretty insane that she cheated on her prior husbands and that was okay, but God forbid someone do it to her. Roberto then stole her car and fled back to Mexico City. This was the last she would ever see of him. The city also found out about her illegal boarding house, the Samaritans, and shut it down. But of course, this was not the end of the story either. Dorothea was charming and determined. She somehow managed to move and open up another boarding house in the 70s at 2100 F Street. And this was not far at all from the first one that she opened. This place was also much larger, so she could take in more victims. A 16-bedroom Victorian house. She had a full staff, holiday meals, and invited social workers over regularly, which shows how much money she had been making. She had been raking in all these government checks. How else would she have afforded this? The tenants would then hand over their financial rights to her, and if they agreed to do this, they were seemingly treated well. But if they saw into her scheme and refused, these people were neglected and kept secret, hidden in the basement. So there would be all of these people trapped in the basement while she's having these parties with social workers and politicians upstairs. It was insane. In town, people saw her as this grandmother and a pillar of the community, a hero, this woman who could cook amazing food and had these immaculate, gorgeous, colorful gardens. She would fuss over her vegetables and rose gardens. She took her teeth out in conversation, faked medical conditions, and she told people she was 10 or 15 years older than she actually was. When she lost her good looks, she realized that she could get away with more if she played up this grandmother role. She was continuously praised in the community as this sweet old lady who took in those less fortunate. She ran all of these charity events, hosted these immaculate dinners and fundraisers, and she grew these deep connections in politics and with social workers. In fact, a lot of her victims were referred by their own social workers. She had a room in the house filled with fake medical degrees as well. She had even at one point convinced an actual doctor that she was a doctor, and he, without asking for any kind of proof, invited her to come work for him and be his assistant. I don't think that this actually ended up happening, but that just goes to show how many people bought in to Dorothea's lies. But not everyone believed Dorothea's ruse. A retired social worker named Mildred Ballinger says she first met Puente in the late 1970s. Puente told her that she had cancer, but this woman lied so much that Ballinger realized this woman couldn't keep her story straight. Because every time Ballinger would talk to Puente, the cancer had seemingly moved to a different part of her body. First she had breast cancer, then she had brain cancer, then it was liver. Puente also spoke some passable Spanish, like we talked about at the beginning of the episode. She was often taken in by Hispanic families when she was growing up. So she knew enough Spanish between that and living in California that she could pass as Hispanic to some people. She lied and said that she had been born in Mexico and grew up with 17 siblings. So all of this is interesting to me. It seems like this was like one of those fantasy narratives and not necessarily manipulative, because if you lie about this, it doesn't necessarily hurt anyone, but it just goes to show how deeply, in my opinion, that she longed for a real family. She had never had that. She also donated to Hispanic arts and education programs in her community while providing cheap medical care to her tenants and other patients, for which she would make house calls. So that was another thing she did. She had like all these crazy schemes spinning, and one of them was showing up to make house calls because she was this holistic doctor. Sometimes she would also tell people she was a nurse. It was really whatever fit her narrative at the time. She would sometimes tell people she was a nurse in World War II, so she was really experienced. The local Spanish community even published newspapers about Dorothea Puente. They began referring to her lovingly as La Doctora. She became known as the godmother of the Spanish artists as well, sending her stolen money to charities and artists throughout the Spanish community. But Dorothea wasn't just conning, stealing money. She was doing something much more dangerous and dark, darker than anyone could have ever imagined.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Neighbors began to first grow suspicious of Puente when she took in a local man named Chief and quote-unquote adopted him. Chief was this very gentle homeless man in the community who suffered from alcoholism. She took him in as a tenant and also hired him as a handyman. But she had Chief doing some weird things around her house. So, for example, one of the jobs she gave him was digging in the basement and removing a bunch of soil and garbage, quote unquote, from around the property. And he then put in a new concrete slab in the basement. Then, shortly after he completed these jobs, Chief vanished. He was never seen again. For 4 short months, Puente was also married to another man named Pedro Montalvo. He initially was a tenant and worked on the grounds for Dorothea. He was also an alcoholic. The marriage didn't last and was soon annulled. She would continue, though, to use his last name over the years at times for various crimes. In 1977, Puente also got in trouble with the law, getting caught forging checks again. She was asked to go to therapy, but wasn't really given any jail time. And this would be the second time that Dorothea lost a boarding house, and I think the fourth time at this point that you would think that's where the story ends, but of course not. She began working odd jobs and quickly went back to forging checks. In 1979, she began working as a nursing aide with no credentials. Soon after this, she rented another place, a second floor apartment at 1426 F Street, a powder blue two-story Victorian home with a beautiful back garden. Keep in mind, this is 1979. Police wouldn't knock on her door and dig up her garden until nearly a decade later. She lived on the second floor of this apartment for some time and often would babysit the landlord's children, and she was known to be a wonderful tenant. Dorothea would continue to go out and make house calls. One of her patients was Esther Busby. Esther kept getting hospitalized with a mysterious illness. She would be fine, get sick, be fine, get sick again, and it seemed like, weird thing, she was only getting sick when Dorothea Puente was around. How about that? One of the doctors got worried about Esther and actually contacted APS, Adult Protective Services. He was suspicious of Puente. He also ordered blood tests to be done, and they found a high level of phenobarbital in her system. Dorothea lied and told Esther's family that Esther was dying of cancer, and that's why she was taking care of her. But what she was actually doing was drugging her and slowly draining all of Esther's money. Eventually, Esther declined so much that she was put into a nursing facility. And at one point, Dorothea came and visited her. She brought her food, and Esther immediately became sick again. This time, Dorothea Puente's actions were lethal. And this is the first confirmed time that we know without a doubt that Dorothea Puente murdered. Esther died, and once again, the doctors were suspicious, but they couldn't prove anything, apparently. So Dorothea Puente continued on with her schemes and murders. In 1981, she targeted Dorothy Gosling. Dorothy survived, but would later recount when Dorothea was around, she would often pass out and wake up to stolen items. January 16th, 1982, another victim, Malcolm McKenzie. So McKenzie was the 74-year-old guy that Puente met at the Zebra Club in Midtown. She accompanied him back to his apartment. They had been drinking, and he began feeling unwell. It seemed Puente had put something into his drink. She basically paralyzed him. He was like eyes wide open but couldn't move his body and was just in this haze on the couch. And while he was in this stupor, she stole his cash, his penny collection, and his jewelry, all while he just watched her do it, unable to move. Before she left, she coldly approached McKenzie, noticing the diamond ring on his finger. She pulled it off and left. He laid alone on his couch for hours, probably not knowing if he was going to survive. But eventually the drugs did wear off, and McKenzie immediately called the police. They caught Dorothea trying to cash two of his checks. Once again, you would think that this would be a time that Dorothea would be tried and put in prison. She was arrested and released just a couple days later, saying this was all a misunderstanding. Like, what the hell is going on? 1 week after her assault and robbery of McKenzie, Dorothea had also already found her next victim, an 82-year-old woman named Irene Gregory. She gave Irene a false name, telling her that she was Bethany Peterson. She drugged Irene and robbed her. She took a bunch of her medications, too, including sleeping pills, and she would later use these on other victims. Claire Malaville and Loretta Calmers also suffered a similar fate, but they were too sick and elderly to testify in court. Dorothea knew exactly who to target, and in my opinion, law enforcement, society also taught her that she could get away with these things, and she was. Dorothea's crimes continued to escalate, and by the time it was 1982, she had no doubt become a cold-blooded killer. In late 1982, Puente met 61-year-old Ruth Monroe. Ruth's son, Bill Clausen, remembers Ruth fondly. She raised five children on her own after losing her husband. She was a good mother, she was a great grandmother, and was known to be a very upbeat woman and healthy. She had gotten a clean bill of health from her doctor just 1 month before she would move in with Dorothea. Ruth Monroe met Dorothea through Harold, one of Puente's co-workers at this restaurant, because Dorothea was also working as a cook. This woman has so many jobs, I can't keep up. Ruth and Harold fell in love and later got married. Ruth and Dorothea became good friends during this time, and they even opened a catering business together. Dorothea also opened this little cafe with the help of Ruth under their joint bank account. Ruth was falling for Dorothea's lies, and Dorothea was playing the long game. She developed a long-term friendship with Ruth before anything would happen to her. In early 1982, Ruth's husband, Harold, started having health issues. He was diagnosed with cancer, and his health declined so much that he needed 24-hour care. He was living in a hospital, and Ruth was very depressed and lonely. So, Dorothea suggested that Ruth move in with her. On Easter Sunday, 1982, Ruth moved in. Shortly before she moved in, Ruth went in for that annual doctor's checkup. She was super healthy. Everything was great. 2 weeks after moving in with Dorothea, Ruth Monroe would die. Bill, Ruth's son, would stop by and visit Ruth regularly after leaving work. He would later say in a documentary interview, quote, "The last 3 days of her life, she seemed like she was getting sick. And when I went there, I noticed she had a drink in her hand. And my mom did not drink. So I asked her, I said, 'What is that?' And she said it was a drink that Dorothea fixed her to calm her nerves." This became a regular occurrence. It seemed like every single time Ruth's kids, she had a daughter as well, would go to visit her, they would see a creme de la menthe drink in her hand. And Ruth was getting worse and worse every time her kids would come visit her. She became so sick that one day when Bill showed up, she was nearly catatonic. Bill also had no idea that Dorothea was the one who was doing all of this. He thought that she was just getting sick and that she was overcome with grief from what was happening to Bill's father. Bill thought Ruth was in good hands. After all, she had told the family that she was a nurse, and she had been friends with Ruth for some time. She had built a lot of trust with Ruth and her family. Each time Bill left, he would assure her, "Don't worry, Dorothea's taking care of you. You're in good hands." Ruth was in such bad shape, she was unable to tell Bill that she needed help. Ruth died on April 28, 1982. The cause of death was respiratory depression due to a massive overdose of codeine. Dorothea claimed Ruth had killed herself because she was so depressed about her husband's illness. But if you look at the evidence, this didn't make any sense. Because when police arrived, they would find that this Tylenol and codeine wasn't anywhere near Ruth's body. It was in another room entirely in the house. And we know that Ruth was bedridden. Additionally, when the autopsy on Ruth's body was done, it was clear that Ruth Monroe had some liver damage and that she had not eaten for several days. The only thing in her stomach was creme de menthe. Ruth's death at this time was listed as undetermined. Ruth's children were suspicious. They knew their mother wouldn't have and wasn't capable of killing herself. But no one was investigating Ruth's death. And so, Dorothea Puente continued to house the elderly and disabled tenants in her boarding house. While they lived there, she read their mail and took any money and Social Security checks that they received. She paid each of them monthly stipends, but kept the remainder for what she claimed were expenses for the boarding house. Over the next several years, law enforcement would visit Dorothea Puente's boarding house, ordering her to stay away from elderly persons and not to handle government checks. But nothing would happen. They would basically just show up and be like, "Hey, stop doing that. Okay, cool." And despite these frequent visits, she was never charged with anything. So Dorothea continued to drug and rob people. In one of her sprees in the early 1980s, she drugged 3 women with tranquilizers, stole checks, money, and valuables from their homes. One of these victims was a 49-year-old woman named Dorothy Osborne. Two of these victims were also hospitalized, and medical testing revealed high levels of unprescribed drugs in their systems. These attacks led to Dorothea getting arrested again, and this was largely because Dorothy Osborne took samples of the remnants of the drink that Dorothea had dosed her with, and she personally brought it to the police station. She brought them the evidence on a silver platter, and Dorothea was arrested May 19th, 1982, while she was in an airport getting ready to flee to Mexico. In August 1982, Dorothea pled guilty to fraud and theft. Not attempted murder, mind you. So, a superior court judge sentenced her to just 5 years in prison at the California Institution for Women in Corona. Dorothea was released on good behavior after serving 3 years. She was paroled in 1985 at the age of 56. Shortly before her release, she was evaluated by a state psychologist who diagnosed her as schizophrenic and said, quote, okay, listen to this quote. "This woman is a disturbed woman who does not appear to have remorse or regret for what she has done. She is to be considered dangerous, and her living environment and/or employment should be closely monitored." End quote. Okay, schizophrenic, disturbed, not capable of remorse, dangerous, needs constant monitoring. But of course, none of this would happen. When Dorothea got out, she went back to the same shit again. She went back to the same house as well, that two-story powder blue Victorian home. She was preying on vulnerable people, collecting their social security checks, and murdering. This went on for 3 years. She did this without a license. She was in direct violation of her federal probation. According to Sacktown Magazine, quote, "Federal probation officers visited her numerous times over the next 2 years without suspecting she ran a business, lulled by her kindly facade and clean home, as much as by her lies that those staying at the house were friends or guests," end quote. Oh yeah, you see these 20 people staying at my house? We're just hanging out. They come and go as they please. They're just friends. Yeah. In the fall of 1986, Betty Mae Palmer, age 78, would arrive at Dorothea Puente's boarding house shortly before she disappeared. Betty Mae Palmer had fallen on hard times. She was having a hard time paying medical bills. On October 14th, 1986, Dorothea stole Betty Mae Palmer's California ID card and put her own photo on top of it. 2 months later, the mailing address on Palmer's social security checks was also changed to Dorothea's address. Dorothea would forge Palmer's signature and cashed nearly $7,000 worth of benefit checks belonging to Palmer. On October 21st, 1986, Dorothea summoned a notary to the hospital room of her next victim, Leona Carpenter, age 78. Leona, weird thing, had suffered a flurazepam overdose. I wonder how that happened. Dorothea was given power of attorney over Leona Carpenter. She began cashing her social security checks just 10 days later. In December, after Leona Carpenter was released from the hospital because she got better, she went to live with Dorothea. And once again, Leona Carpenter would return to the hospital. Just a few weeks after she was discharged the second time, February 1987, Leona Carpenter disappeared. In February 1987, James Gallup, age 62, moved into Dorothea's home after recovering from a heart attack and brain surgery. Dorothea poisoned his food after he refused to give her financial control. July of 1987, 58-year-old Eugene Gamel was found dead in an apparent suicide in her home, having overdosed, quote-unquote, on amitriptyline and ethanol. Dorothea, who was Gamel's landlady, said that he had a history of suicide attempts. sounds a lot like what happened to Ruth Monroe. On October 2nd, 1987, Vera Faye Martin, age 64, was also sent to live with Dorothea. Vera Faye Martin was a mother, and she was poisoned after living in Dorothea's home just one day. Beginning on October 5th, 1987, Dorothea forged a number of Vera Faye Martin's Social Security checks, totaling over $7,000. On October 19th, 1987, Vera Faye Martin failed to contact her daughter on her birthday, as she did every year. Her daughter and other family grew worried and suspicious, but nothing came of the missing persons report. On October 21st, 1987, Dorothy Miller, age 64, was placed in an upstairs flat in Puente's home. She was a Native American Army veteran, and she moved in because she had been suffering from alcoholism, night terrors, and PTSD. So she just wanted help. Dorothy also enjoyed reciting poems, and she was known to be very gentle. Just a few weeks after Dorothy moved in with Dorothea, she disappeared. On November 20th, 1987, Dorothea hired a carpet cleaner to remove a, quote, large pile of foul-smelling slime out of Dorothy Miller's room. Dorothea continued to forge Miller's checks, totaling over $11,000. On November 29th, 1987, Brenda Trujillo sent a letter to the Social Security office in Sacramento accusing Dorothea of stealing her Social Security checks, totaling $3,500. Trujillo had met Dorothea in the Sacramento County Jail in 1982, and the two had later been cellmates. So she was even taking victims while she was in prison. Dorothea never stopped. After Trujillo's release, she moved into Dorothea's boarding house, where Dorothea had helped her apply for Social Security benefits. Trujillo claimed that Dorothea drugged her and called her parole officer, resulting in her parole being revoked and preventing her from receiving the checks. The next victim was 55-year-old Benjamin Fink. Fink also struggled with alcoholism and pulmonary issues. We don't know much about him, but he disappeared in April 1988. Endless victims and secrets, and all things that were preventable. The deaths of these vulnerable people were so preventable. It's so sad and enraging and frustrating. So many opportunities that law enforcement had to intervene and put a stop to what Dorothea was clearly doing over and over and over. But no, this went on for nearly two decades. Finally, in November of 1988, someone did their job and Dorothea's house of cards would come tumbling down. And that is where we're going to leave the story of Dorothea Puente for now. An unassuming landlady with a growing trail of secrets and a house that doesn't quite feel right. In part one of this two-part series, we have seen how she built her facade of kindness, how Dorothea drew in people that society had tossed to the side, and how the cracks in her story began to show. In part two, those cracks become a chasm. I will walk you through the day that authorities stepped onto that quiet Sacramento yard with shovels, and the moment that the first body was uncovered. How investigators realized they were standing on top of a burial ground. We'll follow Dorothea as she's questioned, arrested, and put on trial. We'll look at how she maintained her innocence even as the evidence piled up. We'll also talk about what's become of that infamous house. Why people still visit it, how it's turned into a strange kind of landmark, and what it means to a community to live with a past this dark. Make sure that you're following along so you don't miss part two of this Dorothea Puente series. Next time, the garden gives up its secrets, and the nice old landlady at 1426 F Street will face the world. Thank you. hope you guys enjoyed part one of this two-part true crime deep dive. I don't love having to break these things up. I'm sorry, but I do have a full-time job and I need to make sure that I have proper time to edit, research, and get this episode ready for you in a quality that I'm proud of. So thank you for your patience. And if you enjoyed, be sure to let me know. Drop comments down below if you're watching on YouTube. If you're listening on a podcast platform, you can leave a 5-star review. On Spotify, you can drop comments. That's always appreciated. And we will wrap everything up next week. You all are amazing. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe. And I will talk to you next week. Bye.
Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast, is hosted, written, and produced by me, Kadra Brannon. This show is proud to be a part of the Black Cat Network. Assistant editor is Charlie Leopold. Theme song by Patrick Thompson. All music used in this episode is from Pixabay. If you like the show, be sure to share it with others and leave a 5-star rating and review. Contact, support, and merch links can be found in the episode description. To unlock early ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus content, join the Perplexed Society at patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. Listener stories, topic requests, and business inquiries can be submitted to perplexitymysterypodcast.com or emailed to perplexitymysterypodcast@gmail.com. Until next week, stay curious.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.